Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Can you just describe what you're doing now?
So right now, I'm going to get ready to brew up a Jebbina.
And what's a Jebbina?
So the Jebbina is the Ethiopian coffee pot.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Wing, and you're tuned to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. And this is Solomon Dubé. He's the 29-year-old founder of Café Avol, a cozy little coffee shop in Rainier Valley. It's one of the only places in Seattle where you can get Ethiopian coffee brewed the traditional way in what's called a Jebbina. It's a clay pot with a long neck and a short spout.
When I first bought my first Jebbina, my aunt would examine the Jebbina. She'd put her ear against the straw and she'd knock on the bottom of the pot and just to hear it, to see if there's enough airflow going in it. But it's very interesting.
So they're all handmade?
They're all handmade.
Solomon was born and raised in Seattle, but his family is from Ethiopia, where the coffee plant was first discovered. And they take coffee seriously. But it's not just about the taste. It's a whole event.
The thing that I like about it, about the Jebbina, is the social aspect. So typically, like, my mom would invite her friends over and they'll sit there for about 2 to 3 hours, maybe an hour, you know, just hanging out and just drinking and just sharing coffee. And you'd go through 3 rounds of the Jebbina. The first round is called Avol. And that just signifies, like, it's like just the richest, the first round, and everybody knows, like, hey, you know, this is the first round. But what will happen is they'll add water, rebrew the pot, and you would get a huletenga, which means second. And that's the second round that we'll go to. And then once we're done with that pot, we'll do the third round, which is buttercut. And when you get to buttercut, it's like that signification, like, okay, we're done. We'll say our final farewells.
It's so much more involved than going to a coffee shop right now where you could text your order ahead of time.
Right. It's not something that's like you're just your quick in and out, let me go live my life. It's more so like, well, what's going on in your life? What's the latest topic that we could talk about today? One thing I noticed in Ethiopia was how I was really at peace when it came down to just the social aspect of life. I mean, you know, people work, people get their things done, but they found a way to really just be at peace and just chill. I'd wake up in the morning, my aunt would cook breakfast and would be at the house, and shortly after, it's time for the Jebbina time now. And here we go again.
Do you see this coffee shop creating that setting here?
Yeah, it's sort of building that culture of sitting down and sharing coffee together. And in Ethiopian culture, when we eat injera, it's one huge platter for everyone to eat with. And the same thing with the Jebbina. It's one coffee pot for everybody to drink out of. They say that when two people eat for one plate, they argue less.
So how do you find peace in a hectic world? For Solomon and his family, it's sitting around drinking coffee together from the Jebbina. Today on Sound Effect, the theme is peace of mind. We're telling stories of that search for calm and what happens when you find it. Just ahead, we'll meet two sisters who decided it's better to know some horrible news than not. We'll also hear about the peace that comes from righting a wrong that was committed decades ago. These stories and more today on Sound Effect. So just because you have peace of mind about something doesn't mean things are okay. Sometimes that feeling of calm comes when there's just one less thing to worry about. This is the case for two sisters, Lori Cullen and Tamara Cullen Evans. Lori and Tamara watched their grandmother and their mother deteriorate quickly from Alzheimer's. It turns out their mother and grandmother had a very rare gene called a presenilin gene. And if you have it, you are guaranteed to get Alzheimer's, and you'll probably get it at a younger age. If you have children, there's a 50% chance they'll inherit the gene. Lori and Tamara have always been close. They even do the same work. They're both naturopathic doctors. They decided to get tested. They both have the gene. Tamara is 46 and lives in Maui. She joined us by Skype. Lori is 53 and lives in Edmonds, Washington, and came into our studio. She doesn't regret getting tested. In fact, she takes comfort in knowing what's happening to her.
Well, for me, it was a relief. It helped inform my life so that I could put things on the front burner instead of just waiting.
What are you doing to have the glory days now?
Well, many things is I'm trying not to work so hard, and I'm trying to get things sort of squared away so I can retire early and specifically get the bucket list things done. And one of them was last summer, when I rode my bicycle across the United States, and with the support of Tamara and her husband, who were my SAG team, my support team. That was outstanding. But Tammy's probably got more bucket list things than I do. She's younger.
Yeah. Tamara, how did receiving this diagnosis change how you're living your life?
I really didn't think I had it. And so for me, finding out I did was a little bit more of an abrupt, you know, slam into the wall. It really pushed forward the dream that both my husband and I had of moving to Hawaii. And so we did that this last year, and just making that leap to get here was really amazing. So honestly, every day that I'm here is like fulfilling my bucket list. It's amazing. Otherwise, you know, I just want to have as much time as I can to watch my kids grow up. I'd love to see grandchildren someday. And you know, just see how they do in their lives and see as much of that as I can.
Well, a lot of people would be really angry. Do you struggle with that?
You know, truthfully, I haven't been angry because it just doesn't do any good. And I often think if I'm angry, that's usually fear. There's fear behind anger. And then I just would have to figure out, what am I afraid of? I mean, when I found out Tammy had the gene, it was harder for me to hear that news than finding out the news about myself. Because I wanted to be the one in the family that took this on and managed it and dealt with it. I didn't want anybody else, especially Tammy. And knowing that she has it too was just, it was so sad for me, and I'm not going to be around to help her. I might physically be here, but I won't cognitively be able to help her when she starts to get sick. And that, if anything makes me mad, that's the part that makes me upset.
I want to talk to the two of you about the global research that you're involved in. I believe it's the Dominantly Inherited Alzheimer's Network, or the DIAN study. And it's tracking people like the two of you who have this gene. Does being a part of this research make going through all of this just a little easier?
Yeah, I totally agree. That's, you know, one of the reasons that you stick with it, honestly. You have to think about the bigger picture. It might help me. It really might. And I'm open to that. And that would be wonderful. But chances are more likely that it will help younger generations. It is a great feeling to be part of it and to know that at least our family has this little niche where we can maybe make a difference.
Wow. And do you know what the medication is that you're getting or possibly getting?
Yeah, the arm that I'm in is called gantenerumab. The other one's called solunazumab, and that one's done with an IV once monthly also. These two seem to have the most favorable data for possibly preventing the amyloid plaque laydown in the brain. One of the things with our gene is that the gene causes us to make a lot of the beta amyloid protein at a higher rate, at a bigger rate. And so you're more likely to get the plaque laydown and the tangles that develop as a result of the protein.
Fascinating. Wow.
Yeah. So they're hoping that the drug will it hasn't shown, neither of these have shown much promise in reversing any sort of, tangles that have occurred, but they're hoping if we start it, you know, at our ages, that it will prevent them from happening.
It's almost like taking a lipid for your brain, mm-hmm. like a cholesterol drug to prevent buildup.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And Lori, are you starting to experience symptoms?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do those look like?
It's decision making. I'm having a harder time at work. And it's sometimes just even staying present in conversation. And word finding. I'm faculty at Bastyr University, and sometimes my words get all screwed up when I'm working with my students. And I used to speak all over the country. Where I'm having to really scale back with a lot of the things I used to do, and I try to, I do more things alone, and but that's sometimes that's not quite right either. So that's why I have my dog. So at least I have that him to check in with while I'm hiking or whatever. But and who knows? I mean, something else. Something else might do me in before the Alzheimer's. But at least I have this to sort of inform what I'm really experiencing and how to move forward and make as much intention in my life as possible.
So. I love you, sis.
Oh, I love you too. I miss you bad.
I know, same here.
That was Lori Cullen and her sister, Tamara Cullen Evans. Lori is preparing for another big bike trip this summer. You're tuned to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. Our theme today is peace of mind. And if you're an inmate in a prison, finding any kind of peace can be difficult. There's no privacy. You have very little control over your environment, your schedule. And let's face it, there's not a lot of beauty in jail. A few members of the Seattle Symphony are trying to give inmates some relief. Trio with the symphony recently played for a group of about 40 inmates at the Monroe Correctional Complex. It turns out that both the musicians and the inmates get something out of these performances. 88.5's Ariel Van Cleve was there and brought back this audio postcard.
My name is Steve Bryant and I play the violin. I do know that when we play well and we have good instruments, we're professionals, and we play great music, that there's magic in it. And that magic, I can't put into words. I just know that it's there. I've accessed it so many times and I feel it. And when I listen to it, if I get goosebumps, that's good. That means it's working. It's touching the heart. These are humans. We are all humans. This music does not belong to the people with money. It doesn't belong to the people who can afford to go to the concert hall. Everybody deserves it. They need to hear it. I don't need to know what an inmate has done. They're humans. And I think the power of music to transform us as humans, what could be better?
My name is Joy Payton Stevens, and I play cello. I've probably played in the prisons at least 4 times. In a lot of ways, it's almost better because these guys, they listen with such respect and attention, and they're here because they really want to be here. I guess they could be, you know, doing any number of things at this time, but the guys that are in this room are here because they opted to come listen to us, and they listen with the most rapt of attention, and it's kind of a special environment. I think that music and art in general is one of the most powerful things, and I think that everybody needs to commune with that in some form or another, and I think the more the better, but not everybody always has that option.
My name is Dion Thomas, and I have heard the symphony here for the first time. Music moved me, and on various levels, and so I was just very appreciative that people of this caliber cared enough to come in here and hang out with us.
My name is Kevin Brewers. This is the first time I've ever watched the live symphony up close. For me, being up close like that, I could feel the energy live a lot differently than listening on the radio or whether on an MP3. And it was a really moving experience because I could really feel, and just watching them move, it was almost like a Tai Chi of music, you know, as they had a lot of just, you know, it was real natural.
Well, if I'm just being honest, I had somewhat of an emotional response to it, because Kevin and I have been friends for years, and he'll tell you that I play the piano and I sing in multiple languages, and it's kind of I'm a Detroit kid and who never really had these opportunities to learn classically, but I can like sing arias and stuff like this. And so I think it's a very ironic thing for me to finally have an opportunity to hear these kind of kindred spirits.
I found it very refreshing, and I just found the overall mood and just the way people normally act compared to the beforehand and then after. I felt that it was just much more, the room felt real stable and just, you know, real calm waters.
I happen to be of the Jewish faith, and today's like a really important holy day for us. It's Passover, and it's like, wow, and it's all happening. It's like, music is all about timing, right? And mathematics and order, and here it all lines up to like one of the most important days in my faith. It spoke to this idea that I have value, and that many times, I mean, prison is the ideal circumstance of compartmentalizing, right? We're gonna put everything in its place. And it's to be able to say that, no, I'm a part of the bigger community. I'm a part of something so much bigger than myself. And it spoke to this idea that you don't have to be limited because of your circumstance.
That audio postcard from 88.5's Ariel Van Cleave. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today our theme is peace of mind. And this next story is about a Seattle woman who was a fighter for peace and gave the world a big piece of her mind 100 years ago. Her name was Luis Olivero, and she was really ahead of her time. She was outspoken, highly educated, raised by a minister with a strong moral compass.
Luis is Washington's patriotic anarchist, which sounds like a bit of a contradiction in terms, but with the ACLU currently reminding us that dissent is patriotic, I think she's very current for the times.
That's historian Michael Shine. He researched Louise's forgotten place in Seattle's history of radical activism. So back in 1917, Louise worked at the Seattle office of the International Workers of the World. This was a powerful union. It was better known as the Wobblies. But it was Louise's own private activism that landed her on trial for espionage. Sound effect producer Allie Ferguson talked with historian Michael Shine about Louise and how her unique moral outlook got her into a lot of trouble.
She was, above all, a woman who believed deeply in nonviolence in all things. Her main idea was that all governments are based on the threat of violence ultimately to enforce obedience. So she was strongly nonviolent in the sense that she didn't believe any organization, including the state, had a right to compel people to do things through threat of violence, such as throwing somebody in jail or other punishments.
What time period are we talking about? What was going on in Seattle and the larger world at the time?
We're talking about 100 years ago, 1917, which is the year that the United States entered World War I, and Elihu Root, which is a name that was once well known. Isn't that a great name? Elihu, it's sort of musical. He was a former senator and secretary of war, and he was on a national preparedness tour in which he went around from city to city speaking in favor of supporting the war effort. He came to Seattle Saturday, August 4th, 1917, and Louise and her friend Minnie Parkhurst attended. And at that rally, Elihu Root said, "We are in this war. We must stay in it. We must bring it to a successful conclusion. Don't argue the cause of the war. Don't wrangle over whether we should be in it. Don't speak about the whys and wherefores. Forget all that." And few things were more offensive to Louise than for a man to get up there and tell her not to think and not to argue and not to question.
What did she do to then act on her conscience?
At that time, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which was around then, printed the names of the first roll of draftees, and it was kind of considered to be a roll of honor. But Louise used it as a mailing list, and she wrote these circulars or pamphlets that she had printed up at her own expense. And she mailed one to each person who was on the list of draftees. And in those circulars, she said that it was
essential. It was essential, we counsel, but one thing, obedience to your own conscience. We do not ask you to resist the draft if you believe the draft is right. But if you are opposed to offering your body for these purposes, then resist. Refuse to go. Stay away.
Stay away.
So basically, what was she saying?
Well, she urged every individual to follow their conscience as a higher law than the law of the government.
And so how did the draftees who got these letters from Louise respond?
Well, we know how one of them responded. One of them turned the letter over to the district attorney, Clay Allen. That was a fellow named Mr. Harvey Leach. I don't make these names up. So he wasn't very happy to get it. What happened was that the postal inspector was called in. In those days, they used the post office to control the mailing of what was called non-mailable material. And anything, any pamphlet urging disobedience to the draft had been deemed by the postmaster to be non-mailable material. So they started asking her about those circulars. They asked her why she was doing it. They couldn't believe that anyone would care enough to do this on her own. And she said that
if out of the 2,000 circulars I was sending out, 5 men were induced to think more clearly and to think seriously of the connection of the individual with the government and with the war, I would consider my work had been quite successful.
At that point, Mr. Allen said, I don't know what to make of this woman. She might be a harmless eccentric. And Mr. Allen said, I think she's a very dangerous woman. And so she was arrested on September 7, 1917.
And so how did the trial go?
The trial resulted in the conviction of Louise Olivero for violation of the Espionage Act, and she was sentenced to 10 years in the federal prison. And she ended up serving 28 months of this sentence, at which point in the post-war era, when political situation had shifted some and it was felt that it was appropriate to pardon political offenses, her sentence was commuted and she was released.
And did she go back to life in Seattle with the Wobblies or what?
No, she did not. She was pretty disillusioned. She went back to Portland and she worked there tirelessly on behalf of women prisoners. At the same time, she did it in a way that avoided the kinds of protests that would get her arrested. She worked quietly with letters and petitions to try to ease the conditions of women prisoners.
And what about the story do you find so compelling?
I think it's important to tell the story because she was a courageous woman, a woman who, as her friend said, was found guilty of thinking. And she made a strong point that was also made by others, and others have been remembered better for it. But they're also all men. So I think it's just important to honor her courage. But I think it's not as simple as people sometimes think. Yay, we want to cheer Louise on. I mean, it feels good. It seems that World War I was a terrible war and it was the wrong thing to do, and she was probably right. But at the same time, should somebody always place their individual conscience over the dictates of the law or the state? Well, that's a lot more complicated. And Martin Luther King struggled with this issue. And he said, one may well ask, how can you advocate breaking some laws and obeying others? The answer lies in the fact that there are two types of laws, just and unjust. I would be the first to advocate obeying just laws. One has not only a legal but a moral responsibility to obey just laws. Conversely, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. I would agree with St. Augustine that, quote, an unjust law is no law at all. So, the tough work is trying to find for yourself, through your own moral values and system, which are the just and which are the unjust laws. And that's where the rubber meets the road, if you will. I think it's a struggle we all need to engage in. It's part of our duty as citizens in a democracy.
So this show is under the theme Peace of Mind, which we interpret in a lot of different ways. But I'm wondering if you think that peace of mind is sort of inherently elusive for those engaged in activism and dissent and trying to understand their own moral compass.
To the contrary, I think it's the path to peace of mind. You can't stay quiet in the face of injustice. And that is when you are most conflicted. And when you've taken some sort of action, and it doesn't have to be, you know, throwing a brick through a plate glass window, it can be calling a representative. When you've taken some sort of action and feel that you have tried to make a difference, then you're working your way towards peace of mind.
In Louise's story, when she tried to act on that, she became disillusioned and found, I don't know that she found peace of mind. How can we sustain activism and continue this fight for morality or for justice without becoming disillusioned or maybe losing sight?
You know, nobody said self-governance is going to be easy. Every generation has to fight its own battles, and you're never there. The struggle is never over, and there's always somebody new to pick up the torch.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
That was historian Michael Shine talking with sound effect producer Allie Ferguson. Michael is on the Speakers Bureau for Humanities Washington. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wing, and this week our theme is peace of mind. Have you ever lost something that's really important to you, something taken from you? Maybe it was a house that was always just one payment away and you couldn't keep up, and back to the bank it went. Or maybe you were on the losing end of a war. You keep your life, but all of your wealth is gone, your possessions. This is what happened to the Blockbauer family, except their story ends with a sense of justice, and that even though the world can be cruel, it can also be fair when you fight hard enough. And with this injection of hope, your mind is put a little more at ease. During World War II in Vienna, Austria, the family fled with the clothes on their backs and some diamonds and pearls stuffed into their pockets. Some of these jewels are on display in Peter Altman's home. He lives just south of Tacoma, right on the water.
This is a half of a diamond spray that was my grandmother's. My brother has the other half.
These beautiful, shiny trinkets are a sliver of a fraction of what this family once owned. Decades after World War II, Peter's mother, Maria Altman, won a nearly impossible battle to get something larger back that the Nazis had taken down from the wall of their family's elegant Vienna apartment. The apartment belonged to Peter's great-uncle, Ferdinand Blockbauer. And Ferdinand, he made lots of money by refining sugar.
He had a castle in Czechoslovakia. He had a summer house on a lake a few hours away. He had just musical string instrument collection, which had to include a Stradivarius, I imagine. I mean, and he had a world-famous porcelain collection. So the Klimts were a very small part of his wealth.
By the Klimts, Peter is referring to portraits of Ferdinand's beautiful, beguiling wife named Adele, done by the Impressionist painter Gustav Klimt in the early 1900s.
Back then, there was more formality. There was a Victorian veil over everything that made everything proper, and sex was taboo, and that's what made Klimt such a renegade, is his paintings were very sexual, and the culture didn't allow that, and so that was part of what made him a rebel of the time.
You've probably seen the one portrait of Adele that is better known as Woman in Gold. It glows. The piece is layered with gold leaf. Primary colors of paint are dotted here and there, with Adele draped in jewels, wearing a beautiful dress. She's part Vegas showgirl glitz and part high society elegance. Not only did Klimt paint Adele, the two were friends. They hung out with the likes of composer Gustav Mahler and Sigmund Freud.
At that time, women couldn't go to university, and Adele wanted the education, and so she had a salon and hosted these famous people to come by. And so everybody who was famous at the time in Vienna at that turn of the century was the world capital. And so, yes, Freud was Viennese and a lot of composers. So it was a place, and they all came to Adele's because she hosted these events.
Adele died of meningitis in 1925. She was 43 years old. Then the war happened. Germany invaded and took everything. The apartment, gone. The violins, the porcelain collection, and all those paintings, gone. Most of the family knew to leave the country. Some were killed, some took their own lives. Some were sent to concentration camps and managed to escape. Adele's great-niece, Maria, Peter's mother, fled to the United States with her husband and ended up settling in Los Angeles. Adele graced one of their walls.
We had a poster, I have it in my house here, that my mother had. It was, what we'd call a movie poster. It was just a poster of the painting, and that's what was in our house for 40 or 50 years. And so we knew they were our uncle's paintings, but we thought he had given them to the museum, that they were willed to the museum, and not until 1998 did we find out they weren't.
By 1998, Peter was working for public transit in Tacoma, and that portrait of Adele Blochbauer, his great aunt, it had become an iconic national treasure in Austria, the Mona Lisa of Austria, the Statue of Liberty of Austria. The family thought that Ferdinand had left this painting and others to the Belvedere Museum in Vienna, but a reporter discovered that Ferdinand's final will, it didn't say this. Maria hired a lawyer and sued the Austrian government. After 8 years in U.S. and Austrian courts, she won.
Live from ABC 7, this is Eyewitness News.
An Austrian court cleared the way today for an L.A. woman to reclaim family-owned art that was seized by the Nazis.
I had always hoped that justice would find its way, and it did.
My mother was only motivated by justice and that a wrong had been committed. This was equivalent to what David and Goliath must have looked like at the battle, because the Austrians had all the money, they had the paintings, but what motivated my mother is she knew her uncle Ferdinand, and she said Ferdinand was a very vengeful man in that if you crossed him, then you were not going to receive generosity from him. So when you steal from him and kill his friends, she said there's no way he'd then want to say, oh, you may have the painting. And so that was what the battle was, is just getting them to return what they took.
In 2006, the portrait of Adele Blochbauer was returned to Maria, but it never ended up on the walls of her home. There was no way for her to logistically keep it safe. She sold it for $135 million, a record at that time. Today, it hangs in the Neue Gallery in New York. The money was divided up in the family. Peter retired early and was able to buy his home on the water. Peter says his mother's fight to regain her family's possessions kept her going for a long time.
For mother, I think there was a feeling of her job was done, and I think she kept herself together until after it was over. After the victory was done, then the dementia started creeping in, but until then I didn't see any. In other words, sometimes people just hold out. She said oftentimes she was interviewed and she said, the Austrians are waiting for me to die. I won't give them the pleasure.
In 2011, Maria died, knowing that she had finally done right by her uncle, Ferdinand. She was just shy of 95. And this family, it has so many incredible stories. To hear how Peter's uncle escaped being captured by the Nazis, go to our website, knkx.org. This is Sound Effect. I'm Jennifer Wing, and our theme today is Peace of Mind. And for our last story, we spend a little time with Tacoma singer-songwriter Ben Union. Growing up, Ben really wanted to be a preacher. Religion was a huge part of his family's life. But as he got older, his faith faltered, and he turned to music instead. Ben joined Sound Effect producer Kevin Kniestad in the KNKX Performance Studio to play some music and to talk about how his plans changed.
I was actually born into the biggest evangelical movement at the time in the world in the 80s in Kansas City. My dad and mom were leaders within that group. Lots of good things happened. Lots of scandal happened. It was like the height of evangelicalism in the 80s. So in and out of those movements to church plants like of 20 people to we moved to Australia. We were all over the United States, kind of like a military family. Then moved to Washington State because Dad and Mom got offered a job in Washington State. So we came up here, got involved with the denomination up here. And then just jealousy, politics, religion. Religion is a big deal to a lot of people, so much so that they fight and kill each other about it. And I experienced not the killing part, but definitely the fighting part. All that to say, it was a very defining thing in my life. And a lot of what I write about now are remnants of that. And at 19, I was preaching twice a week to our congregation of hundreds of people. I'm an ordained minister. I can do your wedding if you want me to. I maintain my license. All that to say, I went a very different route.
Was there a moment that you can recall where you decided, this isn't the road for me anymore?
In the summer of 2005, somebody within the denomination approached my parents. You try to take over churches and then get denominations involved. It's like politics. It's crazy. We were kind of ostracized and cast out of this movement. And then you realize that all your eggs were in one basket. All your relationships were kind of there. And then the head guy's got a problem with you. Then everybody else has a problem with you. So it's like I was going around the world. I would be in Australia or South Africa or Mexico or wherever, and we'd be doing these music things, worship praise music and like gospel music, and doing teachings with youth and at churches. To have that be ripped from you in a sense, and to be ostracized and lied about and bullied, and then to come through that on the other end, though, I'm not bitter or even angry. It was an experience that was defining, and it taught me a lot about life and perseverance. And I mean, if that wouldn't have happened, I wouldn't be sitting here performing my music that I've been, you know, that I had written, but I had no outlet to perform. I had songs about love and life and coming of age and things like that when I was in that whole world, but I had no platform. So now the platform switched.
Was it hard at all when that platform switched?
Yeah. It was the most devastating thing in my life still today.
How did you handle it?
Oh, not great. Yeah, not great. It was a crisis of faith. It was a crisis of my value system.
I know that a lot of musicians will use their music as a creative outlet or a way to express. But in some cases, you can use a song as almost like therapy, going to a shrink.
Yeah. Last year, I had a physical breakdown from stress and hypertension in April. Went to the ER 3 times within about 3 weeks. It was very scary for me because I never experienced that. Music was a huge part of healing.
Does a lot of your music come from personal experiences in your life? Are you writing about stuff that you know?
Sometimes. My songs are semi-autobiographical, like Chain of Love. To me, it's my revelation of how many times are you going to move on till you find where you belong? Oh, no, I'm not the first. You say you love me more. Those are all questions that could be said of me or just about any of us. So that's really what it is. It's how many times am I going to move on without realizing you got to make some adjustments? And it's not always going to be sparkly.
So could we hear Chain of Love right now?
Yes.
I fell in love with you the very first time we met. It's nothing that I tried to do, no regret. And now time has moved along and my love for you burns stronger, but I don't know if you still feel the same. You don't look at me the same way as you used to. You don't as tightly as you did. And I have questions, but I'm scared of all your answers. Is it possible to find the spark again? So tell me straight, babe, the truth I can take. Am I just another link within your chain of love? It feels so strange, babe. Do you feel the same? Am I just another link within your chain of love? I know I'm not the first. You say you love me more, and that you still care for me, but I'm not sure. And I want so bad to have the conversation. I can feel your heart is slipping fast away. So tell me straight, babe, the truth I could take. Am I just another link within your chain of love? It feels so strange, babe, do you feel the same? Am I just another link within your chain of love? Oh, how many times are you gonna move on till you find where you belong? You don't know what you got till it's gone. You don't know what you got till it's gone. How many times are you gonna move on till you find where you belong? You don't know what you got till it's gone. You don't know what you got till it's gone. So tell me straight, babe, the truth I could take. Am I just another link within your chain of love? It feels so strange, babe, you feel the same. Am I just another link within your chain of love? Oh, tell me straight, babe, the truth I could take. Am I just another link within your chain of love? Oh, feels so strange, babe. Do you feel the same? Am I just another link within your chain of love? Oh, how many times are you gonna move on till you find where you belong? You don't know what you got till it's gone. You don't know what you got till it's gone. How many times are you gonna move on till you find where you belong? Wake up one day and realize you don't know what you got till it's gone.
Tacoma musician Ben Union performing a song, Chain of Love, and talking to sound effect producer Kevin Kniestad. You can see a video of that performance and another song, Stay, on our Facebook page. Just search KNKX Sound Effect. This brings us to the end of our show. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Allie Ferguson. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Parker Miles Blom helps us with photos and video production. Special thanks this week goes out to 88.5's Ariel Van Cleve and John Kessler. Our intern is Amanda Abbott. And you can find Sound Effect on the NPR One app. And you can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. We'll be back next week when our theme is Turning Point.
It did become the Guinness World Book record holder for the tallest cut Christmas tree, and that tree changed everything for Northgate.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.